Hello, and welcome to the audio edition of Beastly Business, the first in a series of animal behavior, human-animal bond mysteries, written and read by Myrna Milani. Chapter 16. Last night I slept soundly for the first time in weeks, and awoke feeling almost euphoric. "We did it, quadrupeds," I happily announced to the pets. "We found McCarthy's goat, and now he can spend all of his time finding Monica's killer." The two dogs and Maddie looked at me adoringly, but a desire for their breakfast rather than any appreciation of my great sleuthing ability most likely served as their primary motivator. Alas, my good mood quickly waned later when the living livestock cavorted outside and I turned my attention to one of the clumps of crabgrass in the lawn that I vowed to conquer every year, but never did. Coincidentally, as I tugged on the weed, my thoughts once again turned to McCarthy's role in this convoluted state of affairs. Whose side was he on? And why? I tugged on another weed, this one a multi-tendriled botanical demon that didn't do as I wished, any more than my thoughts about McCarthy did. Once I mentally linked him to that weed, though, the fact that it didn't yield made me determined to rip it out by the roots. When it suddenly broke off and I flew backwards and sat down hard on the ground, I experienced an overwhelming urge to kick him. Consequently, when my semi-partner chose that particular moment to drive up my driveway, I didn't feel it my objective best. "What are you doing here?" I shouted as I jumped up and brushed myself off, while the pets greeted him joyously, and much to my disgust. "I stopped to thank you for finding the goat." He gave me an only semi-innocent look. "She's on her way home." "Good, fine, you're welcome." The terse reply shot out before I could stop it. "Go find Monica's killer." "There are a few loose ends." I noticed how his blue shirt exactly matched his eyes, and how fluidly he moved as he came up the walk toward me. An image of Will Ravencroft having sex with a former spy, a relatively small spy, in a telephone booth in the basement of the Pentagon, inexplicably occurred to me. While the sane part of my brain told me I definitely should kick McCarthy for triggering such thoughts, the idea of wrapping my preferably naked body around his was damn hard to resist. "Believe me, I tried to tie up the loose ends," I ranted instead. "But we can't tie them up because you're a damn spook." "I'm not a spook, damned or otherwise," he reminded me patiently. "But even if I were, what's that got to do with getting a new shower curtain?" I stared at him and wondered what odds favored the appearance of a deranged teacher, consultant, writer, maybe sometimes cop spook with, unfortunately, wonderful blue eyes and a great body, for a person his age, as we persons of that age are wont to say, in my yard talking about a shower curtain. Then I decided deranged and spook were synonymous terms. Nonetheless, I concluded the odds were astronomical. "I need to replace the shower curtain the goat ate," he continued when I kept staring at him. "I thought you said you knew where I could find one." "Am I really supposed to believe you drove all the way out here just to ask me where you could find an ugly shower curtain?" "It would be polite, as you would say." He didn't quite succeed in hiding his agitation. "But no, I don't expect you to believe that's the only reason I'm here." "Do I want to know the other reasons?" I eyed him warily, knowing for sure that even if hot sex was on Chandler McCarthy's agenda somewhere, it wasn't at the top of his list right then. "Probably not," he shrugged. "I wanted to ask you some questions." "Will you promise to forget about the damn goat and find out who killed Monica if I answer them?"
"I can't."
That reply fell out of him like a chunk of lead. effectively squashing my stupid romantic fantasies in the process. "What do you mean you can't?" I drew myself up so he didn't look quite so big. "That was a deal. I'd help you find the goat, you'd help me find Monica's killer."
"As I recall, the deal was that you'd tell me what you knew, and I'd handle it," he countered dryly.
"Well, I would have if you ever answered your phone or email, or listened to me the few times you did."
"Put down the plant and get in the car." He distractedly gestured toward his vehicle. "We can discuss this while we get the shower curtain."
After summarily dismissing Walmart, Kmart, and every other mart I could think of as too highbrow for Bubbles Lamar's taste, I directed McCarthy to Harry's Bargain Heaven.
"What is this place?" he inquired as he surveyed the eclectic collection of half-dead plants, used office furniture, outdated cosmetics, and fishing paraphernalia.
"Harry buys stuff no one else wants. You know, the stuff that falls off the truck and then gets run over," I explained as I barely squeezed between a bin of half-deflated beach balls. "Today's bargain, 3 for $1, and another filled with bags of ferret food that looked like they were years older than the world's oldest ferret."
"I don't see any shower curtains," my befuddled partner remarked dubiously as he watched a woman wearing a helmet of pink foam hair rollers stagger by him, carrying an ancient IBM Selectric typewriter.
"Believe me, if another such abomination exists, it'll be here," I told him confidently as I jumped over a pile of last year's calendars. After pausing momentarily to orient myself, I plunged ahead.
"Success!"
I alerted him as I began pawing through a mound of vinyl shower curtains, seeking the tackiest green one I could find.
"You can't be serious!"
McCarthy shrank from the pea-green monstrosity covered with tiny soccer balls that I held up in triumph less than a minute later.
"Trust me, the green will match the mermaid's tails perfectly."
"But it's covered with soccer balls. I need one with bubbles." My shopping companion bristled like a porcupine at what he evidently considered a major breach of honesty, if not necessarily good taste.
"Not to worry, no one will ever notice,"
I used my best edgy porcupine soothing voice. "After all, who in their right mind would have a shower curtain covered with soccer balls?"
"B-b-b-"
McCarthy sputtered helplessly. "It's a steal for $2. I stuffed it into his hands and shoved him toward one of Harry's checkout angels. Once on the road again, McCarthy traded in his dazed expression for a thoughtful one I found far more unsettling than comforting. For reasons I had yet to comprehend, and didn't particularly want to, sometimes I knew his thoughts exactly, while other times I might as well try to comprehend the mental workings of a dung beetle. "Why didn't you say anything to the police about Weintraub attacking you and stealing those samples?" His question proved that his thoughts currently dwelled in the realm in which I could read him like a book. "I have no proof that he did."
"So?"
McCarthy's eyes thankfully remained glued to the road. "I thought you wanted the police to investigate the case more thoroughly."
"I do."
I twirled a clump of curls nervously. "But without any proof, all I'd wind up doing is implicating myself. Then they'd want to know about my relationship with Monica, and all the lurid details would wind up on the front page of the paper. She deserves more than that. And maybe you don't agree, but I think I do, too." McCarthy passed an overloaded logging truck with less room to spare than I found prudent before he spoke again. "How did Weintraub know you took the goat?" he asked, this time opting to look at me instead of the road. I turned away from him and stared out the side window. "Just a lucky guess, I guess."
"How can we work together if you won't communicate?"
I weighed the disadvantages of confessing my criminal ineptitude versus the advantage of possibly upgrading the level of communication with my sometimes partner, and reluctantly chose the latter.
"I accidentally left my business card at his place,"
I admitted in a barely audible whisper.
McCarthy's grip on the wheel tightened and his jaw tensed. He murmured something I couldn't make out. "Excuse me?" I looked at him inquisitively. "I said, sweet Jesus," he replied. "Oh." I scrambled for some way to change the subject, but he spoke again before anything occurred to me. "Do you always do that?"
"Do what?"
"Leave your business card at crime scenes."
"It was an accident. I was trying to clean up goat droppings with it."
I explained in an effort to justify the oversight. But it was too small, so I used my hands. He mumbled something else I couldn't understand, but this time I didn't ask what. After mulling over other aspects of the great goat caper some more, I felt compelled to break the silence. "What happened to Sabrina, Jeff Weintraub's dog?" I casually inquired.
"Why do you want to know?"
He eyed me skeptically.
"Stop acting so suspicious if you don't want me to think you're a spook. I'm a veterinarian, remember? I want to be sure she isn't starving to death in that cottage, while her owner does hard time at the big house or whatever."
"It'll be a long time before Weintraub does hard time anywhere," my traveling companion muttered darkly. "He's probably out already." I pondered the many ramifications of that troubling statement.
"But his dog has to do 10 days.
McCarthy interrupted that process with a ramification that hadn't occurred to me. Once again, he correctly read the look on my face and answered my unasked question.
"She bit one of the officers who went to the cottage."
"They went to the cottage to get the dog?" The act struck me as kindly, but rather unusual.
"No, they went looking for evidence,"
came the brusque reply.
"The missing report?"
He nodded.
"Which they didn't find."
He favored me with an extremely severe look before adding, "However, they did find a fresh set of tire tracks in the driveway that didn't match Weintraub's car, and a few small, feminine footprints and handprints, not just fingerprints, mind you, entire handprints throughout the house in addition to Weintraub's. Oh, and a few pieces of the letter from Weintraub's superior, confirming the details of his termination and severance package scattered around his garbage can. Did I mention those?"
"And?"
My mouth was so dry I had to disengage my tongue from the roof of my mouth before I could choke out that one word. "And fortunately they accepted my explanation that you'd probably drove to the cottage looking for someone to help you with a goat, you being so small." The blue eyes bored into me mercilessly. "And that the small, feminine handprints and footprints most likely belong to the now cremated dead woman, and that rodents probably got into Weintraub's garbage, all of which, luckily for you, they accepted." I would have challenged his portrayal of me as a small, feminine rodent to the law enforcement community had I not realized that my story about stumbling upon the goat in the woods was as lame as Tiny Tim Cratchit. "For future reference." He didn't exactly shout, but I could tell it required a heroic effort for him not to. "If you're going to lie to the police, for God's sake, make sure the lie fits the bloody facts."
"Sorry," I mumbled and hunkered down in the seat to make myself as small as possible so he'd forget that I was there.
It didn't work. Soon I could feel him staring at the top of my head. Then he started in again. "You can investigate all the dogs and cats and even all the bloody bugs in the universe for all I care," he lectured me sternly. "But stay away from the people. No people. Do you understand?" I nodded meekly and stared at my hands, convinced it never helped me now. He didn't say another word until we pulled up in front of my house. The police took Weintraub's dog to the veterinary clinic about 3 miles north of here, he announced casually. "I suggest you go take a look at it." I looked up at him in astonishment. "Look, I do think you're different," he admitted with a somewhat grim smile, "but not unstable, at least not unworkably so. Let me know what you think about the dog." Without thinking, I threw my arms around him and gave him a quick kiss, then fled into the house. It took him forever to start his car and leave. After McCarthy finally drove off, I watered my houseplants in an effort to sort out my numerous and varied thoughts. Those regarding that spontaneous display of affection, what was I thinking? To say nothing of its effect on the rest of my body, proved so unmanageable that I quickly opted to ignore them. Instead, I concentrated on how to fulfill his orders to investigate only the animals in the case. As luck would have it, Matty chose that exact moment to favor me with his most inscrutable look, thereby compelling me to analyze the problem even more critically. I have to prove to someone who knows next to nothing about animals why he should spend time investigating a murder no one thinks happened when he's been hired to find a report worth millions. I reiterated the key point to the orange tiger, who marched beside me as I moved from the fig tree to the African violets with my watering can. Although articulating this even to such an attentive, albeit feline, audience didn't do that much to comfort me, it did stimulate me to look at my assignment with excruciating objectivity. All I was talking about was a dog with a serious behavioral problem, and I worked with them all the time. The only difference was that this time, I didn't know which dog had the problem, and the problem had resulted in someone's death. I turned to Elizabeth, who attempted to dig a tiny spider out of the corner with her fat feet. "May I have the list of suspects, please?" She immediately stopped pawing at the floor and scrambled to my side. I laughed and reached down to fondle her airplane ears and peer deeply into the dark brown eyes, peering equally intently into my own. "You're absolutely right," I told her as I cradled her muzzle in my hand. "We have three suspects. Sabrina, the cop-munching Doberman, Devil, the disappearing Rottweiler, and Jason, the drooling lummox. And no clues." I thought about that for a moment, then corrected myself. "No. Only one clue." You've been listening to an excerpt from Beastly Business, an animal behavior and human-animal bond mystery written by veterinary ethologist Myrna Milani. For more podcasts, commentaries, books on animal behavior and the human-animal bond, and links to behavioral and bond sites, check out my website at mm@mmilani.com. For more specific information, feel free to email me at mm@mmilani.com. All rights related to the book Beastly Business in any form are retained by Myrna Milani. The background music in The Steppes of Central Asia by Alexander Bordin is used with permission of Katova Arts, www.katova.com.